Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Jim Soteros, a member of the club's Health and Medicine member-led forum and chair of this program with Bill Grant, an osteopathic approach to the obesity epidemic, a timely remedy. And now it is my pleasure to introduce the moderator and panelists. Our moderator, Shelley Berkeley, was called away on a family issue, and we asked Dr. Clearfield to be moderator. We're so pleased he accepted. Thank you, Mike. So our moderator tonight is Dr. Michael B. Clearfield. He is professor and dean of Touro University, California's College of Osteopathic Medicine. The panelists are Dr. Jean-Marc Schwartz, professor of biochemistry and director of the Translational Research Clinic at Touro, and associate research endocrinologist at UCSF. Dr. Jay Shubrook is a diabetologist and a professor and director of clinical research and diabetes services at Touro University, California. And Dr. Tammy Hendricks is associate professor and associate dean for clinical integration at Touro. And now, an osteopathic approach to the obesity epidemic, a timely remedy. Dr. Clearfield.
Thank you, Mr. Soteros, and thank you for inviting us to present today. This topic might seem a little bit bizarre of why would there be an osteopathic approach to obesity, and hopefully we'll clarify what we mean by that as we go through the various presentations. A little bit about who we are. Touro University, as you may or may not know, is located in the Bay Area. We're in Vallejo. For our first 2 years, we were in San Francisco, and then we moved in 1999 to our current campus, where we do have an osteopathic medical school, also a school of pharmacy, a PA school, school of education, public health school, and the school of nursing. And the reason I bring that up is a lot of what we need, we think, to do with the obesity epidemic, and really healthcare in general, and all the topics that are forthcoming here, all are in some way interrelated to this obesity epidemic because it's so prevalent. And really, we can't do it as one group of healthcare providers. It has to be a team. So the interprofessionalism is something that we try to emphasize in our curriculum. Now, why the obesity epidemic? Well, as you're probably all aware, this has now gone global. It's been global for approximately the last 50 years or so. And let's see if we can... And if you look at when it started, it's not that long ago. In the 60s and 70s, for the entirety of humankind, there was almost no population where there was over 15% of the adult population having a body mass index greater than 15 or 20, 30, which is the definition of obesity. And then all of a sudden, it started to occur. And if you look at where we are today, we have obesity at approximately 35% of the adult population, with being overweight or obese, close to double that number. Now, one of the things that has come out from the NHANES data recently is that this steep increase seemed to have leveled off a little bit since around the year 2000. So that if you look at this here, it shows that from 1980 to 2000, the obesity rate doubled. And then from 2000 to 2012 or so, it went up, but not nearly at the same alarming rate. So that gave some people a little bit of hope, saying that we're getting a handle on this. But how this started was in 2000, when the government decided to put up Healthy People 2010, there was a growing concern that the obesity rate in the country was in the 20-23% range, and they needed to get it back down to that 15%. So we put all our resources for our nation together to do this, and then let's see how we do in 10 years. And and 2010 comes out. We get our report card, and the report card shows that instead of going down to 15%, it went up to about 33%, 34%. So then, as any good bureaucracy does, we set up Healthy People 2020, which we're currently under. And now we're well over halfway through this decade, and we're still in the 35% range for adult population. And it's also going up in the younger generations, which Dr. Hendricks will talk about in a minute. So if you look at this, what is the cause for this? Why is this happening? And one of the reasons is that it's also how we're defining obesity. Now, the BMI is how we generally categorize it, and that's a body mass index that you calculate from height and weight. But there's another way to look at it, and Dr. John Mark Schwartz will talk on this a little bit, in reality, in how it relates to abdominal obesity or central obesity or obesity around our organ systems or ectopic fat. All these have an increase in pro-inflammatory mediators that can cause some of the sequelae that we all know with obesity, diabetes, increased cancer risk, heart attack risk, etc., that's related to this. So when we're looking at it from our perspective, we're trying to relate all these things together so that even though we're not escalating at the same level of BMI, we are increasing, and this shows here how we're increasing the increase in our waist circumference at an alarming rate, and that continues. So that if you look at it on average, it, in 2003, it's gone from 50% with a body waist increase of over 35 inches for a woman or 40 inches for a man, up to about 54%. And this continues to rise. So that is part of the alarming part of this. Our way of looking at it, Toro, is we train medical students. We train other health professionals. So what we're trying to do is how can they be more effective than our prior practitioners have been in addressing this issue? And one of the things that we're looking at is going back to step one. What do we actually know about this problem? How can we better educate somebody? Because what we know is that there are stereotypes out there, that people look at people who are obese and overweight and consider them frequently lazy or unmotivated. They have a lack of willpower. They have a loss of self-control. They have areas where they can't control themselves or gluttony. And what happens is that when these people are exposed to such stigma, they are more likely to have a higher weight, a higher BMI. And what's even more disconcerting is some of the people that have the highest bias against the obese population are actually those they are most dependent on, the healthcare providers, including physicians, and their family members. So that is how the osteopathic way that we're trying to look at is changing. And what you'll hear in the next couple minutes is three different ways, and then we'll try and tie it together. Again, just to give you a very brief thumbnail of how we're trying to approach this from a way that if we can educate people better, maybe we can change the bias. And if you're not biased to begin with, then maybe you'll have a better effect in having a more appropriate outcome. So with that, I'd like to introduce Dr. Hendricks, who will talk about this from the pediatric perspective.
Thank you, Dr. Clearfield. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm going to be focusing on pediatric obesity and what we're doing about it. If we just look at some simple statistics, over the last 30 years, we can see that the childhood obesity rates have more than doubled. So in 6 to 11-year-olds, we went from a rate of about 7% in 1980 up to 18% in 2012. And those percentages continue to increase, similar to the adult population that Dr. Clearfield just presented. If we look at adolescent obesity rates, we see they have more than quadrupled, so more than four times the rate. 12 to 19-year-olds went from about 5% of obese in 1980 to 21% in 2012. And again, those numbers continue to increase. So we're talking about our future generations and how huge this is impacting them and is going to impact our future. As Dr. Clearfield mentioned, typically when we're diagnosing obesity or we're calling somebody obese, we're using the BMI scale. The BMI scale takes their weight over their height squared, that's in kilograms and meters, and if that number is higher than 30, then they're considered obese, and that's for adults. It doesn't work the same way with kids. For children, we're looking at growth curves. So we're looking at a BMI curve. And that's really the way that we diagnose obesity in pediatrics. So if we look at this curve here, we can see that For a 10-year-old with a BMI of 23, that would put them above the 95th percentile. And this is compared to the ideal, not compared to today's percentiles, but compared to the ideal that is set by the World Health Organization. So a BMI greater than the 95th percentile is considered obese. A BMI above the 85th percentile, so 85th to 95th percentile, is considered overweight. And below the 85th percentile is considered normal. So that 10-year-old with a BMI of 23 would be in the 95th percentile or in the obese category. If we look at a 15-year-old with that same BMI of 23, they're now in the normal category, a normal healthy weight category, so between the 5th and 85th percentile. So we can't just look at the BMI number itself. We have to plot it on a growth curve. The complications of pediatric obesity, just like with adult obesity, it affects every single organ system. So we see problems across the body when somebody is struggling with overweight and obesity. We see problems on the skin, something called acanthosis nigricans, which is a thickening of the skin, usually on the base of the neck, sometimes in the armpits, shows us that the person's body is not reacting to glucose the way that we expect them to. We can also see infections, increased fungal infections, especially in the folds of the skin. We can see problems in the GI system, so increased rates of gallstones. So we're having more and more pediatric patients need to go and have their gallbladders removed because their terrible diets are creating this sludge in their gallbladders. We're seeing higher rates of constipation, higher rates of reflux. Something called non-alcoholic fatty liver disease or fatty liver disease, as you increase your adiposity, so as you get more fat on your body, it not only collects on the outside, but it also collects internally. And this is something that Dr. Jean-Marc Schwartz is going to talk about too as he moves into his presentation. But one of the places that fat accumulates in our body is in our livers, and it can cause our livers to not work as well as they would before. We also see huge complications with cardiovascular disease. So we're having children diagnosed with hypertension in younger and younger ages. We're seeing these diseases that we used to only consider adult population diseases in these younger populations. Heart disease, high cholesterol. The psychological impact of pediatric obesity is staggering. We're seeing children that have anxiety, that are developing eating disorders, higher rates of depression, more teasing and bullying, more low self-esteem, more academic decline or poor school performance. In the pulmonary section, so the lungs, children have obstructive sleep apnea. Again, something that we used to only associate with overweight and obese adults, we're seeing in younger and younger populations. There's a higher rate of asthma in patients that have obesity. And then we're seeing children that have precocious or premature puberty, so they're developing puberty much earlier, most likely due to their obesity. We're seeing children being diagnosed with prediabetes or type 2 diabetes, something that used to be called adult onset diabetes, that we can't even use that terminology anymore because we're diagnosing it in younger and younger children. So we're focused on the community. We're focused on this global event. But I want to bring us back to patients, right? It's our patients that matter. Our individual patients are who we're doing this for. And as we touch more and more individual patients, the impact should be greater and spread out across the community. So I want to talk about one of my patients, an 8-year-old male. For the purposes of this presentation, we'll call him Joey. Joey has been seeing me for the last couple of years, and I've been following his obesity. So initially, his BMI was above the 99th percentile. So he fell into that category of obesity. Each time he's come in to see me, his BMI has gone up and up. I ordered fasting cholesterol levels or a fasting lipid panel on him, and he has high cholesterol. He has prediabetes. He has hypertension. He has the problems that we should really only be seeing in adults, and he's 8 years old. Joey's mom tries really hard to get him to eat well, tries really hard to get him to exercise. His parents are divorced. He spends his weekends with his dad. Each time he comes in, Joey's mom gets very, very tearful. Oftentimes, Joey gets very tearful, too, as we take a look at his charts. And she says anytime he goes over to his dad's, he can just eat whatever he wants. So he's dealing with this difficult dichotomy of what's happening at one parent's household and what's happening at the other parent's household. Joey has recently admitted that he's being bullied at school. He is very depressed, and we're starting to see his grades come down. He used to be a fantastic student, used to be really enthusiastic about going to school, and now he doesn't want to go to school anymore. So he's just one example, and I can think of hundreds more. There are so many patients just like Joey, and this is why we're doing it. This is the importance of it. How did we get here? How did we get to this population where we have almost 30% of our children are being diagnosed with obesity and dealing with these adult problems? I have an image up here that says weapon of mass destruction, and it shows a bunch of pictures of things like hamburgers and breads and all of these high fructose corn syrup, very low nutritious foods that you can purchase very inexpensively for large mass quantities. So it's cheap and easy to fill up on these type of foods. We have an increasing number of something called food deserts. Food deserts are areas where affordable, nutritious food are not available. They're areas oftentimes in urban situations where a family may not be able to go to a grocery store where there's access to fresh fruits and vegetables. The closest place for them to purchase foods may be places like the liquor store down the road or the fast food restaurant across the street. We're seeing a decline in parks and playgrounds and the ability for our children to go outside in safe places and spend more time outside. There have been studies that just sending a child outside to play more often decreases the rates of obesity. But if we don't have a safe place for our children to play, then how could we send them outside? Our kids are spending more and more time in front of screens, staring at screens, playing on video games, playing on cell phones, on tablets. So what can we do about it? An osteopathic approach to children. One of the first tenets of osteopathy is to look at the whole person. We don't just look at an organ system. We don't just look at the diseased body part. We're putting it all together. So as I'm looking at a child with pediatric obesity, I'm looking at their family situation. I'm looking to see where they live. I'm looking at their community, taking all of that into account as I'm trying to come up with a plan for how they can help their child to be as healthy as they could possibly be. The American Academy of Pediatrics has a recommendation for our overweight and obese children, and it's the 5-2-1 almost none rule. 5 stands for 5 servings of fruits and vegetables. We should encourage our children to try to eat 5 servings of fruits and vegetables every day. If they live in a food desert, we need to help them creatively find ways that they can access those fruits and vegetables. 2, no more than 2 hours a day of screen time, anytime they're just sitting still staring at a screen. 1 hour of activity a day. It doesn't have to be all at once. It could be a 10-minute walk in the morning. It could be 5 minutes of dancing in the afternoon. It could be a family walking for 20 minutes after dinner, as long as it adds up to about an hour of good heart-pumping activity a day. And then almost none, and this is probably the lowest hanging fruit, the easiest thing for us to accomplish. It's no drinks with calories. Our kids are drinking far too many sodas, juices, all of these drinks that just have empty calories filled with high fructose corn syrup that aren't helping them at all. And if they could cut that out and transition that to water, that's going to make a huge improvement. We have to be family focused and we have to be community driven. This can't just be focused on one individual. It's not just Joey's fault. It's the entire process. At Toro, we're developing a Happy Kids program. HAPPY is an acronym that stands for Healthy Attitudes Produces Positive Youth. So focusing on a lot of those psychosocial components of obesity to turn these kids' ideas around, their ideas of themselves, of their self-image. It's a community-oriented program. They're group visits so the children don't feel like they're so isolated. And it's doing a lot of positive reinforcement and hopefully will help to drive some of those positive outcomes that we're hoping for. I'm now thrilled to introduce Dr. Jean-Marc Schwartz. He is our director of the Translational Research Program up at Toro, and he's going to talk about some of the groundbreaking research that he's doing that's going to help us as healthcare providers best care for our children and patients.
So my understanding of osteopathic medicine is it's more than just manipulation. It goes into the philosophy and the lifestyle. And I guess I'm not an osteopath, but that's how I'm going to continue if I can manage this. And so one of our interests has been this relationship, and people have pointed out the connection between the high fructose corn syrup consumption that went up in parallel to, and if I can maybe use that, in parallel to the obesity epidemic. So we have those two trends, and it's a correlation, and you know, we know that correlation doesn't mean causation, but it's an intriguing pattern, and people have start to ask questions about this correlation. We are interested to look at it in a more biochemical way and a more metabolic way, and the interesting aspect, as you see on that picture, you see sugar on the top and then you see fat, and you see an arrow in between the two, and actually there is a biochemical pathway that can convert sugar to fat, and that's called de novo lipogenesis, which is basically making new fat from sugar. And you can study that, and you can basically tag the molecules, and like I put a little star on the glucose and the fructose, which are the two components of the high fructose corn syrup. And if you do that tag, if you tag the molecule, you can find in the pathway of the sugar to fat, you can find, you can continue to follow that labeling. It's a stabilizer top, so it's a safe way to label. It's not radioactive. And finally, you can encounter that label into the fat. The most common fat made de novo is palmitate. It's a carbon 16 carbon molecule. So we can try to look at that. So we were very interested to see how fructose and high fructose corn syrup and sugar in general, how important is this pathway. And this become really very obvious with the beverage industry that really has been very successful at pushing a drink on little guys like the one you have on that picture. And what we know is that this sugar is really quickly absorbed. It goes through the gut, and it's make a little bit of a tsunami, a big wave of sugar that goes to the liver. And that's big wave has a lot of consequence because we know, for example, that fructose is metabolized differently than glucose. So it really creates a little bit of a disaster in your liver. So we were interested to look at that. And our initial studies was in human adult, and we find out that when you have this kind of drink, you increase your blood fat, but you increase also your liver fat. So this tsunami really creates a lot of perturbation of your liver and creates some issue that could lead to liver disease and to cardiovascular disease with the blood fat. So we decided to do a study with kids who were high consumer of sugar, and 40 obese Latino and African-American children, and we wanted to look at this pathway. We wanted to give them some tagged sugar, and because they basically had this high habitual glucose or high sugar intake, we studied them with their regular diet at the beginning, and the first day we just look at this conversion of sugar to fat. And we also wanted to look at this blood lipid and liver fat and see how 9 days, just 9 days of fructose restriction. So we took away basically the only thing, we took away the drink and the fructose and the sugar, the simple sugar, and we replace it with complex carbohydrate. Complex carbohydrates are absorb more slowly. They don't have this tsunami effect I was describing before. So we were hoping to see a difference, and we basically measure them after those 9 days on day 10 to see how those parameters change. And as you can see, it's a very dramatic difference. The conversion of sugar to fat is really decreased tremendously just by 9 days of suppression. And the main things, a lot of those kids, as Dr. Hendricks just mentioned, now they have steatosis, or they have fatty liver, and fatty liver is not a good thing. You don't want to store fat in your liver. It's called ectopic. It's outside of the area where the fat is supposed to be, and it comes with a lot of potential disease that go from liver disease to potentially diabetes as well. So in those 9 days, we see a huge decrease in liver fat. I mean, for that short term, it's about 20% of decrease in liver fat. So when you have high liver fat like that, you want to decrease your liver fat. So we see a similar decrease in blood lipid that I didn't show you. So the point of this message is that just taking away the drinks, I mean, and following the recommendation of the pediatric association, is that correct? You take away that fructose and you just stop to convert the sugar to fat. That's a process that's made in the liver. It's called de novo lipogenesis. It will take away the fat and it will reduce your blood fat in a very effective way and very simple way, because we didn't take any of their other food away. The only thing we took away was those drink, and that was very effective to reduce liver fat and the conversion of sugar to fat and also the blood fat. So this study really, I think, supports some simple guideline and public health efforts to reduce sugar consumption. And we hope that you know, this is an easy, it's not that complicated to take one thing away. And it's, I think, effective. You know, we don't know how more potent will be the effect if you increase from 9 days to 18 days, but if you just take it away from your daily practice, I think it will be tremendous. So this study was done in collaboration with people at UCSF, Rob Lustig, that is well known for his work on sugar, also Kathy Milligan, Susan Nowarowski for the measure of the liver fat, and we have Alexandra Guglucci, Grace Jones at Toro University, and now we have a small metabolic unit at Toro, and we are very, very happy to be able to carry on some study in participant and subject interested in nutrition and lifestyle. And so I have the pleasure to introduce the next speaker, Dr. Shubrook, who is a diabetologist and is doing amazing intervention in our campus.
Thank you very much. So I'm going to take a little bit of a step back and also take a little bit wider view. So we've heard lots of really concerning things. You know, not only do we know that adult obesity is a problem, sounds like childhood obesity is a problem, which means we're going to have a bigger problem with adult obesity. We've heard that there are certainly things in our diet and things in our lifestyle that are getting in the way. As an osteopathic physician, I look at the body as being a perfect machine. The body will take care of itself if I allow it to take care of itself. If I give it good nutrients, I use it as well as it is designed to be used, health will follow. Well, I want you to start thinking about our lifestyle as an obstacle to health. So we don't use our body as it's meant to be used. We don't walk, we drive, we sit. Those muscles don't act the way they should act. We eat more calories than we can burn. Our body is doing the right thing by storing those extra calories, putting them in other places. But now we have more calories than our body can handle. So when we do things like that, we start to run into bigger problems. So as an osteopathic physician, one of the things I really want to focus on is how do we stop this progression from obesity at an earlier and older age to diseases which become chronic diseases. And they're all lifestyle related. So before, when we first talked about this presentation, I was going to talk about 1 in 3 Americans have prediabetes. So that's, you know, if you count around the room, you could count off. There's a sizable number of us that have prediabetes. And many of those people are going to go on to type 2 diabetes. I bet every person in this room knows someone, either in their family or their friends, now that have type 2 diabetes. Well, the good news is that last week, a study came out, and 50% of Californians have diabetes or prediabetes. So it's not 1 out of 3, it's not 1 out of 2. and 11% per year of those with prediabetes are going to progress to type 2. This is not acceptable. We have to do something about this, and the things we're doing are not enough. And 9 out of 10 people with prediabetes don't know they have it. So if you don't know you have a problem, how can you possibly address it? So there's an awareness issue that needs to be addressed as well. And we talk about diabetes now as being a serious public health epidemic. I will kind of give the warning that fatty liver is going to be the next epidemic that comes. So our children, when they're adults, will all be talking about fatty liver like we talk about diabetes and prediabetes. Well, I guess the good news that comes from that is that type 2 diabetes is largely preventable and wholly treatable. So this is not something that we're just forced to live with. We can do a lot about it. There was a study done nearly 20 years ago and published in the New England Journal in 2002 that showed that a lifestyle intervention, an intensive lifestyle intervention, could reduce your risk from going from prediabetes to diabetes by 58%. And if you were above the age of 60, you could reduce your risk by 71%. This lifestyle intervention was far more effective than any medication. So this is something that really should have more attention than we're giving it to. And you've heard that the medical organizations are fully on board into supporting this. And this is the AMA's outreach goal this year, is to raise awareness about prediabetes. But prediabetes, the Diabetes Prevention Program, was a very intensive program. You had a personal coach. You had a personal trainer. You met with a dietitian every week. That's a lot of work. That's very hard to implement. And I can tell you, as a healthcare provider, most people struggle with the tools to have an ongoing conversation at how do you manage a chronic disease when it's lifestyle-based. Because, you know, if I only treat someone in the context of that office and I don't take into account their family, their community, and the other things that influence their decisions, I'm not going to be successful. Because if I decide to do something today, but I go home and my family says no, now I have yet another obstacle. So the YMCA actually said, we're going to take this model, we're going to test it. And YMCAs across the country found very similar results as the study in a community-based program taught by lay people. So we said, well, this is great. This is a program that could be implemented across the country. But maybe it's too expensive. That's a lot of, you know, costs. So Avalier did a study with the American Diabetes Association and said, what if we modeled that every person with Medicare was offered the diabetes prevention program? Let's forget whether they actually have prediabetes or not. We're just going to offer it to every person with Medicare. And we're going to see what the outcomes would be on new onset diabetes. And rather than having that 70% benefit, we're just going to take half of that. We'll take 37%. Well, that would cost $7.7 billion over 10 years. That's not a cheap program. But just looking at the cost of healthcare once you're diagnosed with type 2, there would be over $9 billion savings, with a net $1.3 billion savings in 10 years, which could be reinvested in these further prevention programs. So it's crazy that we are not doing this. So what we're doing here at Touro is we're going to tackle diabetes and prediabetes. So we have a campus of health professions, as you've heard, and many of these health professionals have a public health focus. So our osteopathic physicians, our pharmacists, our physician assistants, our MPHs, are going out there, and they have a public health focus, and they're going to work as interprofessional teams to implement the diabetes prevention program throughout, initially, Solano County. And we're going to talk about that. So you've heard all the different people that are on the campus, and because of this public health focus and because of the support of the university, we've now trained people on campus to be certified lifestyle coaches who then go as teams into the community and provide this program for free. This is a great public health service. We have had 138 coaches trained at Touro University. We have 6 active cohorts in Solano County, partnering with the public health department, partnering with local places of worship, the Salvation Army, as well as campus. And we hope to be the first certified CDC-accredited diabetes prevention program provider, because largely this has been in other places. And we feel that the education provided in the diabetes prevention program is so critical for the public, it's crazy for us not to offer it. And on the educational side, we need to build better interprofessional teams of healthcare providers that know how to work together to address all the natures of a chronic disease that's lifestyle-based. There's no one that can do it alone. I see my patients with diabetes 1 hour out of the entire year. I'm crazy if I think I'm going to negotiate major behavior change with such little time together. I really can't even understand their lifestyles. So there was a request for a couple testimonials. So I have a testimonial from a participant in the program and a testimonial from a student. And I'll read this. And this program is really largely designed around people with prediabetes. This testimonial that came in this week was someone who had diabetes who entered the program. The things involved in this program really are healthy for anybody. But the quote was, I wanted to share some good news that I received at my doctor visit today. In January, my A1C number was 9.2. That's a very high sugar, and they average about 300. And my doctor advised me if I didn't get it better, if I couldn't do better, he was going to recommend me I have to go on insulin shots. He said he'd give me a chance to reduce my numbers from 3 months ago. And today I had my visit. My A1C number was 6.6 with lifestyle program. His goal was for me to 6.5. He was very impressed and wanted to know what I did to get these results. I told him about the Toro class, and he said that this is certainly worth a testimony that it should be shared. I couldn't wait to get to our next meeting of diabetes prevention program to share the good news and that my diabetes is currently controlled. I also walked up and down 3 flights of stairs to get to his office for the first time. Thanks for providing the class. So how does that person's feeling free, right? That person has empowered. And that's what we want. We want people to be empowered. And then for a coach, this is one of our coaches. It's given me more confidence and allowed me to practice interprofessional communication skills. Since healthcare is becoming more collaborative, I love that I can work along different students who have different viewpoints on the material. I love getting to know the people in my community on a more personal level. This is really rewarding for the healthcare providers. I get to check on them weekly and ask how their life is treating them. They're more comfortable sharing their struggles and how we can help guide them as a group to reach their personal goals. And again, the group mentality and the time invested in this is critical. The diabetes prevention program is not unique to osteopathic medicine. It's not unique to Toro. You can actually go to the CDC website that I've listed here, www.cdc.gov/diabetes/prevention. This is offered all across the country. It is not offered everywhere, but what's unique here is that in Toro, we are taking this seriously and investing in our own community, offering these classes for free, and training both not only the participants, but future healthcare providers to do a better job addressing chronic disease. So I'll bring Dr. Clearfield back up to talk about other educational things that are addressing the obesity epidemic.
So we've given you a little taste of different areas of things that we're doing, and given the limited time, we just wanted to highlight just a few of these areas. So you've heard things from a basic research perspective in how we're looking at, you know, the intake of foods that might cause problems with our liver, diabetes, et cetera. We're looking at how it's impacting our children and things we can do there and in adults that either have diabetes or are pre-diabetic. So with this, what we decided to do is look at a very fundamental issue, and that is one of our goals is to train the providers of the future today. So what does that really mean? Well, if you extrapolate out what this could look like 10 years from now, should we do nothing different than what we're currently doing, it will be a catastrophe for healthcare. It will burden the system to levels that are unprecedented. So our providers have to have tools to be able to work in the future that will allow them to have the ability to get a handle of this and change the stem of the tide so that it is improving. So what we've done is we've put together a curriculum. Now, this curriculum was modeled after other curriculums that were out there, some looking at family practitioners who were having difficulty training their or treating their obese patients, et cetera. Because the frustration of treating obesity per se, and then all its sequelae, whether it's diabetes, arthritis, liver disease, you name it, heart disease associated with it, is pretty formidable. It doesn't matter what field of medicine you're in, you're going to deal with this because it's pretty much everybody you're going to be seeing or a good component of it. So what we did is we took a focused approach. where we give our students an intense six-hour course in their first year, another four-hour course in their second year. We include it with all their rotations, working through patients with very specific scenarios with obesity related that are different in their third year. So there's a different one in pediatric rotation versus internal medicine versus family medicine versus surgery, et cetera. And this includes epidemiology, includes the pathogenesis, and understanding a lot of what Dr. Schwarz has said, or what Dr. Schubrick's doing, or what Dr. Hendricks has said. We include this in our lecture so that they understand that. And then they work in small groups, and they work this thing out so they have a better way to approach a patient, to have them partner with them to get a better outcome. And as you can see, there's other things that we talk about with nutrition. We go over that in a lot of depth. We talk about how exercise and physical activity is a key component to this. Their self-control and behavior modification. Then when we look at what medications are available, if you need to use those versus other treatments, including surgical. And then other associated diseases associated with the obesity epidemic, and that includes everything from sleep apnea and hypertension, as you heard, through the metabolic syndrome, infertility, et cetera. So with all these different things being done, what we then do is we measure how our students' knowledge is on this by giving them tests. But we start out by surveying them. And our survey is a standard survey. I hate to tell you the name of it, but it's called a fat phobia scale. And wasn't our name, but it's a standardized scale that's out there. And what we do with this is we look at our students as they come in. And we say, are they going to be biased? And anywhere between, on this scale, between a 2.5 and a 3.5 is some bias, and over 4.4 is very biased. And our students come out basically the same as every other student that has been measured. That's nursing students, that could be dietary students, nutritionists, physicians, medical students, doesn't matter. They all come out around 3.5 or so on the bias scale. So we're all biased, and it is inherent in really how we've looked at this problem. And we believe that a lot of this is our own ignorance. We just don't know all the facts. So then what we did is we gave them these courses, and we re-challenged them with this survey. So we resurveyed them to see if the bias improves, and it is improving. And we've been able to show that. And that's really shown here, where when we look at the baseline and then for every year afterwards, it's been improved. Now, the first year we started this in 2011, we also surveyed our second and third year medical students, none of whom got a formal obesity didactic educational group of lectures. They did get it. It was embedded within the curriculum. And their bias actually started to get worse the more they were in medical school. And we found that to be, in some of the literature, to be suggestive that the more you're dealing with refractory people that are overweight or obese, the more frustrated you might get. And that bleeds from the attending physicians and the residents down to the students, so that by the time you're graduating, they're already, that mild bias becomes more marked. What we've been able to show with this over a four-year period in our preliminary studies, which we're just completing, and this sort of shows it from the class of 2015, which was the first class, and they graduated last year, that not only we were able to improve this bias, and it was statistically shown to be improved, but it was maintained through all 4 years. We're now into phase two, where we're going to now extend this into their residency programs and to see if, while they have their cohort of patients that they're assigned, whether we can get better outcomes. And our outcomes are not focused on weight with this. They're focused on health. So as A.T. Still, the founder of the osteopathic profession, once said, anybody can find disease. It's finding health that's difficult, and that's really our focus with this. So to basically summarize where we've gone in an osteopathic approach, hopefully we've given you a little idea of how we're trying to be a little bit different in looking at this from the perspective of health. And if you look at Toro's solution to this obesity puzzle, it's a combination of adding education along with patient care, research, public health, community engagement, and interprofessional healthcare teams. And when we put all these together, we think we're trying to get an impact. We're changing the bias of the providers so that they can understand the patient, relate to them better, hopefully have a better communication so that the outcomes will ultimately be better. So that completes our short presentation. We just sort of tried to give you highlights, and we'll be glad to take questions. Sure. Yeah, we could. Go with the cards. Okay. Okay. Let's just try this one for Dr. Schwartz. Are all sugars bad for you, or is it just fructose?
So fructose is metabolized by the liver almost exclusively, so it makes fructose a different sugar than glucose. But I think there is also this effect of quick absorption, and that could also lead to, even with glucose, it could lead to more processing by the liver and more impact on the liver. Now, if you start to develop diabetes, if you have pre-diabetes, it sounds like people have shown that more glucose is coming back to the liver. So I guess sugar, it's about the delivery, and the fructose in particular, if it's delivered quickly, it's just going to impact the liver in a more aggressive way, the negative way.
Okay, I have a couple here. I'll try this one for Dr. Shubrick. Can you reverse prediabetes? And there's a couple other components to this. Isn't this a large part, I guess, due to socioeconomic class? And then how do we deal with that within our community? And then lastly, are the lifestyle coaches, our students, who is actually doing that?
So the diabetes spectrum, all the way from obesity in childhood, precocious puberty, fatty liver, progressing to prediabetes, then progressing to diabetes, the longer you go on the spectrum, the less likely you can reverse it. So I will tell you that you cannot reverse type 2 diabetes. You can have diabetes that's very well managed. You can even have normal sugars, but the pathophysiology, the part in the body, is still going awry. We believe that if you treat prediabetes early enough, you can really arrest that progression. But that progression is only arrested if you continue to maintain a healthy weight. And so that is a little bit more complicated, and we don't have complete data for that. But I will tell you that the earlier in the process, the more lasting the effects are. Diabetes prevention program, as it's taught at Touro, has been led by student interprofessional groups of students and or faculty or staff, and they're offered to the community of interest. So we actually partner with community groups. They recruit the people. So if we did it at a church, the church would say, is anyone interested in the class? We do the screening. We offer it for the class, for the church. But it is groups of students, faculty, and staff offering to the community. I think I answered the questions.
Socioeconomic.
So we used to think that really it was only related to socioeconomic status, and that's no longer the case. If you look at 50% of Californians, that actually brought, there's no one group you could include there. We know that as an entire population, we've become more sedentary. We're eating foods of higher caloric density and less nutrition. And so it's equally affecting, it affects everybody. It doesn't equally affect everybody. So if you happen to be a person of color, you're at much higher risk for prediabetes or diabetes. If you have someone with a family history of diabetes, you have a much higher risk. If you have a further distance to a grocery store from your home, you have a higher risk of prediabetes and diabetes. But I don't think I think we are on the hook as an entire population now to make a difference. We can no longer say it's just this, it's just that. We are all on the hook for this.
Okay, I have a couple that I'll combine for Dr. Hendricks. Is there any hope for our children? And if so, what approach it works best for the kids?
So, yes, there's hope for our children, absolutely. And implementing a lot of these strategies, and especially involving our medical students, our younger generations of healthcare providers, is certainly one of the ways that we can help our children to fight this epidemic. What is some of the most effective ways of treating pediatric obesity? It's really tough, and it takes frequent visits, which is very difficult on the family. So parents have to take time off work so they can come in to see the physician. And really, it has to be an entire family affair. It can't just be focused on a single child in the family. The whole family has to change their eating habits, change their exercise habits. Kids are the best, and I can certainly say this as a parent too, at doing what you do, not doing what you say. So if you're telling a child that, you know, you have to eat your vegetables, but mom and dad aren't eating their vegetables, then the child's going to learn from what they're seeing. So having the entire family involved, getting the community involved, having frequent follow-up, it takes a lot of work, but it absolutely can be done.
And then there's a group of these that I'll just open it up for everybody. It really has to do with things that we're taking in and diet. So how does meat play a role in this problem? Alcohol and the effect of hormones injected chemically into the products that we eat. So as a group, somebody want to go with that one?
These are complex issues. We are so far from what's normal. There is no intermediate step that we can take to improve that. So if we could all go 100 years back and eat like we did at the turn of the 19th century, our health would look very different. But that we were eating whole foods. We were eating foods that were grown locally. We were eating things that were meant to be put together. When you eat foods that are processed, you're stripping them of the nutrients that they're made to be with. You're stripping them with the fiber they're meant to be with. And the chemistry is really different. I wish I could just tell you, if you cut this one thing out, your diet, you know, our health would be better. We have been changing our diet for 60 years. And those that were kind of remember, well, hey, stop eating meat. Stop, and then we ate more chicken. Stop eating protein. Now we eat more carbs. You know, we will always substitute. We need to go back to a whole food, you know, if you can't see it in a box. It can't come in a box. That's really, to me, the only way we could really move forward. And there are a thousand ways that we have diluted or made our food less healthy, most of them for economic reasons.
Yeah, so I, if you want to do a minimum, I guess processed food. If you take away processed food and anything that comes with a special packaging, if it's not, it's probably not as good as. And a lot of studies actually support that. Alcohol. I mean, the question about alcohol. Alcohol is converted to fat as well very rapidly. So drink slowly, it definitely stimulates that pathway of the novel lipogenesis, and a lot of liver disease actually have been defined because of alcohol consumption or alcohol excess. That's it for me.
How about nutrients? I guess that would be the other thing. Moderation. You know, we don't do anything in moderation. I like a good deal. So I'm all about getting the supersize. But, you know, the consumption of calories is much greater, and so that's part of the problem, no matter what those calories are. Sorry.
One of the things about alcohol, another way to look at it is fructose is metabolized in very similar manners to alcohol. So it's really, a lot of times, fructose is alcohol without the buzz. And we have restrictions on when people can start drinking in this country, but fructose we can give to our kids, and it's causing all these metabolic disorders. So I'll end with one last question here, and that is, what is unique about this osteopathic component that we talked about? Hopefully we gave you some ideas about it, and I'd just like to give you one other. We've been, over the last several decades, dealing with the number one killer in the world, which is cardiovascular disease, and been fairly successful in treating some of the risk factors, whether it's blood pressure, high cholesterol, et cetera. And I've been personally involved in the lipid component, and statins, I'm sure you've all heard of, are very, very commonplace. They're most prescribed drugs in the world, and they have had a profound effect on lowering the risk of heart disease. Yet we still know that even though these individuals are getting their LDLs down, their bad cholesterol down to a low level, heart disease persists. Well, we also know that there's a silent inflammation that goes on in our body. And the biggest probably producer of the silent inflammation could be the actual fat that's around the organs that where it shouldn't be. So will lowering inflammation per se, measured by various markers such as C-reactive protein in the blood, show that you have an improvement? Well, there's several large studies being done today, one through the NIH called CERT, which is lowering inflammatory risk. And then another one's with CANTOS, looking at a different medication to lower it, to see if we lower inflammation, we can decrease heart disease outcomes. These are people at high risk to decrease heart attack, stroke, et cetera, independent of anything else. So their cholesterol is already being treated, their high blood pressure is being treated, their blood sugar is being treated. And those studies are ongoing. Well, we've also are looking at it from an osteopathic perspective. And we know that there are certain ways that we can use osteopathic manipulative treatment to lower inflammation. Now, that's people usually that are symptomatic. They have low back pain, things such as that. But for the silent inflammation, we don't know. So we have a study called RIOT that's just starting now, and that's reversing inflammation with osteopathic treatment. And we're going to see if we can lower silent inflammation within the body without a medication, but with actually a manual technique to treat things that are abnormal that we can find and see if that will have a benefit. And then if the other studies are positive, hopefully from an osteopathic perspective, we'll find a way to add to this armamentarium of treatments that we might have for taking care of this vast problem that we're all dealing with, which is obesity and all its subsequent diseases. So with that, we think that's a very osteopathic-specific approach, but also our philosophy of how we're going at it. Hopefully, we've given you a little snippet of some of the things that we're doing. There's much more, but our time is up. So I want to thank everybody for in attendance and thank the Commonwealth for allowing us to actually present this material.
Thank you. Thank you. Our thanks to Dr. Clearfield, Schwartz, Shubrook, and Hendricks for their program here today. We also thank our audiences here as well as those listening to the recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 113th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.